Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Jason Moitoso.
And I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And today, we go into the unknown. Actually, the very much known, but the very secret.
The extremely cataloged, but extremely obscure.
Exactly.
Or not obscure, opaque.
That's fair. A long-lost art, for the most part. Sam, what would you like to share with the crowd here?
Well, first off, I'd like to share that I love you. All of you. Who are listening and or watching, because theoretically, I know I've said this for the last 3 weeks, theoretically, this is it.
I don't feel attacked at all by that statement.
Good. Theoretically, this is it. We are embarked on our first ever audio video, audible visible journey, audio video AV club journey.
The obvious next step. In the evolution of the Not Alone podcast.
The next step? I don't know. Have you ever seen Shin Godzilla? Okay, in that, he can evolve in real time to kind of adapt to what's going on.
Huh.
So maybe our podcast could be the next Shin Godzilla.
That would be interesting.
And then all of Tokyo would unite to destroy us.
That's smart.
I couldn't blame them. I would do that right now if I could.
We should just send out or do a like subscription box where you get the smells of wherever we're going to be.
Ah!
We're like, hey, we're talking about Bigfoot today.
You mean my spare room?
Swamp smells.
Hey, we might as well just throw out a promo. If you're interested in something like that, but not that. One of our friends, he's the host of the Monsters Among Us podcast, and he runs Cryptid Crate, which is pretty solid. It is a monthly subscription box about cryptids. This is not a paid advertisement. You just mentioned a box, and I thought about cryptids.
What belongs in the box?
Gwyneth Paltrow's head.
Or cryptids. Or both. Maybe it is the same. Who knows?
In any case, today we are going to dive in to the unknown. And by doing so, embark on a journey that very well may take us all the way through the end of the year, depending on how this goes down. It is, of course, October 1st, the beginning of the spookiest month of the year. You are all contractually obligated to watch Over the Garden Wall by the end of the month. Otherwise, you can't listen to this podcast anymore.
I still haven't seen that.
You're a monster. I'm a monster.
We know this.
In any case, we are going to take a look at one of our favorite subjects, alchemy.
Ah, so we're all going full metal on this.
I was wondering how far we'd be able to get before a Full Metal Alchemist reference. Not very far. We're going to go ahead and start our series on alchemy, which, I mean, I know, I'm a very bad planner, but I legitimately can't tell you how long this series is going to be. It may be that we do 2.5 to 3 episodes. I know we don't technically do half episodes, but we could figure that out later. Or it very well could be, depending on how far we want to go with it, we could do 7 or 8. So, we'll just see.
Okay.
Jason doesn't love that, I don't think. Do you want to talk about alchemy for eight?
Interesting.
16 weeks?
Well, I want to talk about it from like the 15th century onward.
That's at least another full episode away after this full episode.
So what you're telling me is the conversation is not going to be an equivalent exchange here.
There's another one. Full Metal Alchemist.
That's all I'm here for today. Because, Edward, Sam, you have a ton of history to cover for us. So that we have context.
I do have a lot of history, a lot of context to cover. And I tweeted about this, and I warned you people. Now, granted, that was about 2 weeks ago. So if you've forgotten, I'm sorry. But the thing about alchemy is that it requires a substantial amount of framework. It requires a lot of getting your bearings in order to understand what's happening. So much so that on our Dark Myths collective, which we are so proudly a part of, one of the shows that we are happy to share that space with is The History of Alchemy. It's an entire podcast about what we're going to try to do in the next 4 episodes. So
I like how you're like, it could take 2 episodes, 3 episodes. First time I'm hearing a 4.
Now we're up to 4.
He's not kidding about that 6 to 8, are you?
I'm really not.
It's going to be rough.
I'm excited. But what we want to do, more so than anything, if I could have one thing in this life when I was 16 years old, it would have been two dudes who gave me a crash course in alchemy over the course of about 6 hours. And that's what I'm hoping to do for you, the listener. Now, it may be more than 6 hours. It almost certainly won't be less than 6 hours. So we'll go ahead and dive right in.
So before we actually dive right in, when I think of alchemy, I tend to think of the precursor to chemistry for the most part. Is that not where we're going to? Are we not going to the age of observation?
You would think of that. That's the interesting thing about alchemy is that for, I think in the public consciousness, most people, when they think of alchemy, they think of it very much as you're describing. And you're not wrong to do so. To think of it as a sort of primitive science, a precursor to chemistry, as we have now, but also one of the first real human innovations when it comes to the scientific method, testing, making verifiable results. That is all completely true on one hand.
Okay.
On the other hand, alchemy is about shedding this hell prison that we are trapped in and ascending into the perfect realm to be perfect people.
So what you're telling me is just like this podcast.
Just like this podcast.
Alchemy is, in a sense, an evolution.
Kind of. It's a spiritual discipline as well as a physical science, which makes it really, really interesting.
Okay, so I guess let's hop in the Wayback Machine. That's got to be trademarked. Whoops.
that is beyond trademark.
Anyway, where are we going? Where does this begin? Where does our knowledge of alchemy stem from?
That's such a good question. I don't know. You don't know. Nobody knows.
Perfect.
But what we do have is a figure, okay? I don't know where this is going to end up. But I do know where this starts.
Okay.
I don't know exactly the very first time anyone did anything alchemical. But for the intents and purposes of our show here, when we're talking about alchemy, especially in the West, because that's the thing to remember, it's not just in the West, but that's how we think of it. But alchemy in the Western world is typically traced back to one individual figure. This figure's name is Hermes Trismegistus. That translates roughly to Hermes the Thrice Great. Now, this name is going to sound fairly familiar to anybody who has ever made a study of alchemy, because he is a cornerstone individual.
So maybe a few of you, but not the majority of us.
No, I don't think so. Because, again, for the public consciousness, alchemy is weird old magic that turned into science, if it even turned into science. A lot of people think of it as just weird old magic.
I thought it was like hocus pocus science.
Right. And it's absolutely not. Well, also, it absolutely is. And this duality is
so no,
central.
But yes.
This duality is so central to alchemy that I'm just jazzed to talk about it. So, Hermes the Thrice Great. Hermes the Thrice Great is the namesake of the discipline known as Hermetics or Hermeticism, which is often portrayed as an ancient school of thought which was primarily occupied with alchemy, theurgy, and astrology.
So theurgy, is that some sort of like metallurgy kind of
So let's break down our roots
here.
Our prefixes and suffixes. Urgy, as you have rightfully said, is like working. So metallurgy is metalworking and the like. And then we have the first bit, the, or theo, as in God.
See, that's what I was assuming, but I didn't think we'd be building gods.
The working of God, the manipulation of God in order to cause supernatural events to happen in your favor. Typically, this is not necessarily seen as especially in a monotheistic standpoint, this is not seen so much as the kind of causing the monotheistic god to listen to you puny mortal, and do your thing, but rather it's typically more associated with the working of like angels and demons. It is also commonly known, well, not commonly, but for those of you who care and know these sorts of things, it is also known primarily as Enochian magic, In our more modern sense, it's what Aleister Crowley used to do all the time.
So it's like making charms of sort, like
it's like
one-off.
It's performing rituals,
okay,
in order to try to bind a higher figure to your will and make them do what you want them to do. So that can be charms, that can be rituals,
so like
that can be magic.
Celestial slavery of some sort.
Yeah, exactly like that. Okay. Which just really goes to show how depraved human beings are. If we're like, ah, there are these perfect beings, I wonder if I can make them my slave.
You know, that conversation we had in the car on the drive home where you're like, it's just so much easier to not do anything.
It's true.
Than to do things.
That's true. We can just enslave the angels to do our bidding.
Hey, if it works, it works. They have wings, right?
Theoretically. Depends on who you ask.
Is it theoretically?
Oh, what does that
mean? Oh, I'm done.
Anyway, so Hermes, Trismegistus, Hermes the Thrice Great, it is from these three disciplines that his greatness comes. He's mastered all three of them. And so it's appropriate that his nature and identity should be a little mysterious and a little confusing. It's easily understood, but difficult to comprehend, just like so much of alchemy, as his identification with the creator of alchemy yields a field which makes such mysteries its stock and trade. Now, Hermes Trismegistus was not a historical individual, but rather a historical entity. And here's what I mean. Have you ever noticed that when we refer to things, especially things having to do with ancient culture, ancient myth, we typically use the Greek system as a way of reckoning things? So, for instance, right, if I want to talk about Baal of the Canaanites, who was a storm god who occupied a chief position amongst the gods, I would probably say he's like the Zeus of the Canaanite.
Right. Well, that's
paradigm.
Because our Western culture loves the classics.
We do love the classics. But even in the classical period, this was going on. You think directly, especially about the Romans, where their gods are basically analogous of the Greeks themselves. There was
same thing with Greek and Roman architecture and artwork and stuff like that too.
Yeah, the Romans were just,
they just ripped them off. Really.
Now let me say, their government systems top notch until the brutal empiricism, but. Yes, a lot of their culture came from the Greeks, and that's because of the high place that Greek thought and Greek life occupies in our Western civilization.
Yeah, I mean, that and Greek trade helps a lot.
Exactly.
If you want to share ideas around the Mediterranean, if you're a group of islands, it makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. Now, this method of comparison actually has a term, and that term is interpretatio Gratia, which means interpretation by the means of Greek models. So again, Greek is the center, and everything else corresponds to the Greek.
It's using a lens.
Exactly.
Common knowledge, common ground to get a better idea across, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Now, this practice was especially prevalent in the Hellenistic period, when the civilization of Greece became preeminent in the world sphere. The practice they applied through this interpretatio Gratia has often incorrectly been labeled syncretic. So, you know, when we think about, like, for instance, Christmas, right? Okay, yeah. So you have the pagan holidays, which were absorbed by the Christians in order to cement their traditions in the pagan world.
Right.
That is a good example of syncretism. But what's interesting is, and this difference here that is so important to our stories of Hermes and thereby all of mythology, is that the interpretation by Greek method is not syncretism. It is its own system whereby when they looked out at the world, they didn't see, oh, well, here's this god and he's kind of like Zeus, so we'll say he is like Zeus. Rather, they will say he is Zeus. So Jupiter is Zeus, right?
Yes.
Who's Saturn is Kronos. Anyway, yeah. So Jupiter is Zeus, right? Mercury is Hermes. that sort of thing, where it is a direct comparison. But the Greeks didn't do this with just the Roman society, or the Romans didn't do it with just a Greek, especially in the Hellenistic period, where Alexander the Great was just storming. He was just all over the ancient world, and he was grabbing whatever he wanted and made it his, up until he died of a mysterious illness that was probably alchemy-related, I would think.
I thought it was an STD.
Could be, probably.
Yeah.
R.I.P. Alexander. As he was storming the ancient world, and Greek influence and Hellenistic culture came about and infiltrated these places, they didn't say, oh, your gods are like our gods. They said, your gods are our gods. They're just in a different name at that point. They believe these other civilizations had a one-to-one correlation between the Olympians, their titanic predecessors, and then the gods that were being worshipped by these other societies at the time. Therefore, any differences between similar deities were not necessarily seen as a reason for saying, actually, no, this isn't Mercury, or this isn't Hermes, this isn't a Baal, as an example, but rather saying, oh, my understanding of Hermes must be different. My understanding of Hermes must be incomplete. If your understanding is different, then that means we should be able to blend the two and create something better, a better understanding. Now, after Alexander the Great dies, you have the splintering of his empire through his generals.
Right.
The piece of that that's especially important for us today is the Ptolemaic dynasty, which takes over Rome, or not Rome, takes over Egypt, rules Egypt, organized around the capital of Alexandria, which, of course, housed the most famous library in all the world, which was then destroyed.
Burn knowledge.
When ships would come into the Alexandrian port, they actually were required to surrender all of their papyri, their codexes, whatever they had. They had to surrender it, copy it, allow it to be copied, and then given back. If they didn't, they just couldn't trade. They just weren't allowed to trade with all of Egypt.
That's a really good platform.
It is a very good platform. They also did this fun thing where they paid a substantial deposit for some very ancient copies, maybe even originals, of the Odyssey and the Iliad. They said, listen, we'll pay the safe deposit. We promise nothing bad's going to happen. And then they were just like, I'm keeping this for myself. And then that got burned down.
Well, what you going to do?
Cry about it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's not like we can go back and fix it now.
Greens, please put us in Alexandria if you can.
If I can find it.
We really should do, like, adventures. That would be fun, like Not Alone Adventures, where they're just strictly video and we're like walking around and we're like finding things. That would be so cool.
We gotta get you a treadmill.
Yeah, we do. Two of them, it sounds like, unless we want to share one treadmill, which could be dangerous.
Well, I hope we're going one direction.
No. Nope. It's time we go our separate ways.
Forward. Okay.
Now, the Ptolemaic rulers were more than happy to go native among their Egyptian citizens. Their willingness to blend Greek and Egyptian culture was evident in a number of ways, but none more so than in the realm of religion. In addition to the creation of a new god named Serapis, who was a combination of two Egyptian gods and five Greek ones.
Whoa.
Yeah. They also devoted an entire cult of worship to Alexander, who passed from being a mere god in his death to being, or sorry, a mere human in his death to being a god.
So he's Talos.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. He is Talos.
he's Talos.
Talos be praised.
Skyrim, for everyone else that doesn't know what we're referring to.
And now Jason's going to flash a picture of Talos on the screen.
I was just going to put the Dragon Board shouting or something, but whatever.
Now, it's out of this environment, this true religious and cultural mixing pot, that the legends of Hermes is something different, that Hermes the thrice great emerges.
Does get confusing.
It does. The Greek god Hermes traveled the Mediterranean and landed in the ancient empire of Egypt. And Hermes Trismegistus is the result of that journey. See, the Greeks identified the Egyptian god of writing, Thoth, or Toth. they identified him, the scribe of the gods, kind of their not their lackey, but their messenger, with their own Hermes. Now, Thoth or Toth had a few different very important things that he did. He wrote everything. He wrote 36,250 manuscripts, which composed...
You just knew that off the top of your head.
Yes, I did. Which composed the sum of all knowledge in the ancient world. He also designed and built the pyramids, or at least designed and oversaw the building of the pyramids themselves. And as the dead were ushered through the realm of the afterlife into the underworld, he sat as the recorder during their trial. So he took the minutes in the court. The two were so closely identified that, again, they defied this sort of syncretism, and they instead became this unique blend that was really only possible at this time and in this place, I would say. They became Hermes Trismegistus. They illuminated each other to show what was in the middle. And that in the middle was the thrice great. Now, Thoth was also closely identified with the ritualization of Egyptian magic, which then became closer identified with the god of knowledge, Hermes. So, again...
That makes sense. It's just really fancy cooking.
It is, in a way.
You have a book, it has a recipe, you do some things.
Exactly.
In order. Hopefully.
So, again, as one of them exists, it illuminates the other. So, whereas before Hermes... Magic wasn't really his big bag, at least in Ptolemaic Egypt. It became his thing because of his identification with Thoth. Now, a Renaissance writer named Vergisius explained how Hermes was perceived, although for the reasons we'll get into in a bit anachronistically, during this time period. He says, quote, "They say that this Hermes left his own country and traveled all over the world, and that he tried to teach men to revere and worship one god alone, the demiurgus and generator or begitter of all things, and that he lived a very wise and pious life, occupied in intellectual contemplation, and giving no heed to the gross things of the material world, and that having returned to his own country, he wrote at the time many books of mystical theology and philosophy." Unquote. So therefore, Hermes becomes identified as the component of consciousness, of the mind himself, with his winged shoes traveling all over the world at the speed of thought. This amalgamation of mind and magic, Hermes and Thoth, transmutated into Hermes Trismegistus, as well as the more ritualized Egyptian magic coming into contact with the Platonic rationality of the Greeks, provided the perfect spawning ground for the practice of alchemy, and its emphasis in divine knowledge providing a gateway to the transcendental realm.
Okay, so how does that deal with alchemy?
We're getting there.
Because we're using alchemy in order to transmute like he has, to some sense or another.
Because this is the figure that starts alchemy. He begins alchemy. He is the original alchemist. Full Metal. Now, another key component, like I said a little bit earlier, of Hermeticism is the practice of theurgy. I think it's theurgy. The conjuring of beneficial spirits or beings or even the gods themselves in the quest for knowledge regarding the mysteries of existence. Now, as the legends of Hermes Trismegistus came in contact with the Hebrews living in Ptolemaic Egypt, another aspect of this character's history and nature came to the forefront of tales about him. Being unable to participate in any sort of a reckoning that compared Yahweh with the gods of the other nations, instead, the Hellenized Jews of the period identified Hermes Trismegistus not with God himself, but rather, still impressed by the oral history and philosophy of what they assumed was a great teacher of men, they afforded him a privileged position as a wisdom bearer. So theoretically, Hermes Trismegistus gets transported back about, well, at this time about 1,500 years, theoretically, to the time of Abraham.
So he becomes like an advisor?
He becomes sort of? He becomes a wandering
mentor,
knowledge giver. Yeah, yeah. Just somebody who goes around teaching the right people the right things at the right time. And one of those people that he taught was Abraham. Now, if you remember, which we probably don't because I actually didn't remember until I went back over the notes because holy crap, I can't remember anything these days. If you remember in our episode about the golem, it was said that Abraham was one of the first workers of Kabbalah and that he was able to do things such as transmuting the ground into a calf to sacrifice for the divine sacrifices. Hermes Trismegistus was the one who taught him how to do this. He's even identified, for those of you who have their bearings, he's even identified with this really interesting character called Melchizedek, who is just this weird guy who shows up and is like, Abraham, give me 10% of all your stuff. And Abraham's like, all right, gotta do it. And he blesses Abraham and gives him knowledge.
Sam, give me 10%
and
increases, of all your stuff.
Nope, I'm not gonna do it. He increases his knowledge and all of that. So again, we have the Greeks and the Egyptians living right in close proximity. Hermes Trismegistus to them is a god.
We've got a mix of culture in general.
For the Hebrews, who have a substantial part to play in the alchemical story, they see him as a great philosopher, a great teacher, even a divine agent, okay, but not divine himself. This is a view that will later be shared by Christian thinkers. And interestingly enough, there are portraits of Hermes Trismegistus in cathedrals around the world. It's very strange.
Okay. No, that's weird. Like,
the world is
I'm
weird.
I'm kind of like, okay, tell me why. Tell me more.
We'll get there.
Oh, dear.
Because we are still in about 1500 BC right now, and we're moving forward.
You're going to give me, like, timestamps so I can just keep changing the background.
Now, the teachings of the Trismegistus were often stylized as dialogues, which is one good indication as to when these teachings may have originated. This form of recording things in a dialogue fashion really was not known before Plato writing down the dialogues of Socrates and having his teacher play a part in those. So we have an idea that maybe they're coming from around that period, but even then, probably a little bit later. Because unsurprisingly, the first Hermeticists that we know of for sure were Neoplatonists. Now, there is a great evidence that they were being taught and enacted these Hermetic doctrines in Ptolemaic Egypt, but these works of Hermetica, as they are now known, were not redacted into their final form until the first century CE, most likely. Now, once they were finished, disciples of Hermes were left with 13 works to guide their pursuits. That number varies. Some people, it's 13, some it's 15. You have a veritable, I mean, just a fight about what is real and what is not. And some people, like Jason, might say, none of it's real. And some people, like me, might say, a good amount of it's real. When these works were actually rediscovered in the Renaissance, which is what led to a huge reinterest in alchemy, which is exactly all Jason thought we were going to be talking about.
Yes.
When they were rediscovered, it was actually thought at first, well, at first they bought the whole thing hook, line, and sinker. They said, wow, these must go back to the time of Abraham. Then, through a little bit of textual criticism, they were able to identify when they came about, which was, again, the first century CE, first to third. But for a long time in that intermediary period, they were actually thought to be just complete forgeries anyway, and that somebody just around the block had written them in the year 1400, 1500, whatever. But these actually did end up being more ancient documents. Now, as Christianity rose in the Mediterranean in power and influence, the practice of alchemy actually did not get stamped out at first as many other pagan traditions did. Instead, alchemy was seen by many Christians as a preferable practice, especially with the rise of Gnosticism. Have you heard of, do you know what Gnosticism is?
I've heard of it, but I don't know what it is.
The Gnostics were some dope individuals thinking some really interesting things. And basically what it comes down to, the meaning of their name comes from the word gnosis, which means wisdom or knowledge.
Okay.
And essentially it is the idea that knowing enough things and knowing the right things will purify you and help you escape from this terrible existence that we live in. It's actually a philosophy that guides my life in a very big kind of way.
Doesn't sound bad. So, I mean, it makes sense that alchemy actually stuck around, because we are talking about early stages of Christianity, Christianity, really, the first couple hundred years after Christ. Like, that makes a lot of sense, that you take something that has already been able to mix culturally.
Yep.
And continue it. That doesn't seem like a hard sell to me at all.
No, no.
So this makes sense. But the question is then, why, how and when does it transform into the alchemy that we all probably relate to a little bit more? And did it die off in between? Was it a Renaissance-esque event for alchemy? Or was it just a breath of new life when it came to material means?
The alchemical Renaissance took place at the same time as the actual Renaissance, which makes it easy to remember.
Well, I mean, it was hearkening back to the classical era.
Yeah. As far as we can tell, the earliest sources are split,
cool.
as you may think.
Perfect.
Or as you may have assumed. So there is evidence even then. I want to say that the absolute earliest evidence of physical alchemy is around the 5th to 6th century CE, which is when we actually have what we're going to talk about a lot more, which are these coded recipes that are then used to perform these proto-scientific experiments.
Right.
And that's happening within, as far as we know, within 200 to 300 years of the works of Trismegistus being redacted into their final form. However, as with everything in the ancient world, it could be a lot older than that, for all we know. That's simply our first means. However, as we get into especially one of Trismegistus's most famous works and really most foundational, we'll see why, at first at least, it seems as though we're not looking at a physical science as much as we are looking at a spiritual discipline.
Okay, so interesting. Well, are we going on that journey now? Where are we headed?
We've been on it.
We're
going. I freaking love all this stuff so much. It's like all my favorite stuff. It's
rolled
long,
up into one.
It's long dead gods mixing with philosophy, mixing with the supernatural. It's awesome, man.
I can't wait till we get to the proto-chemistry.
Ancient history. Yeah, I know. That's what you're all
here for. The proto-chemistry and the secret books. Those are cool.
They're pretty good. They're pretty good.
Coded inscriptions? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, what's interesting is, as I think most of us know, Christianity started as a fringe movement within Judaism. It really gets its bearings, for better or worse, around the 3rd to 5th century, or, well, 2nd to 5th centuries. And that is the time when we see a complete break, and suddenly you don't just have Christians being their very first kind of name were the Nazarenes, because just like the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes, they were a sect of Judaism. So they stopped from being that into Christians, especially with the introduction of this kind of Gnostic philosophy and the Hermetic tint, which is applied to it. So, again, the basic idea of Gnosticism is that we are currently trapped, and we have been since we were born, in a crude material prison which keeps our souls under lock and key. But with enough effort and with probably the intervention and acts of a god, we can leave our terrible flesh prisons and we can ascend into the realm of pure spirit.
I don't know. For my soul, my body's probably a little spacious.
Okay. It's all those gains. And not because your soul is small, because you're a very wonderful man who I am glad to have as a friend.
Thanks, buddy. Anyway.
He gets very uncomfortable when you say nice things to him.
I do. It's horrible. Let's go back to making fun of me and continue with the note. What you got? Oh my gosh,
so,
we're only about like third of the way there.
Oh god, we have so much more to go. It's wild. So, That's the fundamental idea of Gnosticism. In most Gnostic texts, and by the way, when we're talking about this, I don't know how many of you, I mean, like Dan Brown, The Da Vinci Code, he talks about like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. These are Gnostic texts that were written even later than the four canonical Gospels that were used in order to provide this idea that this world is bad and we have to run away from it and die before we can really start living. So
that's a movement millennials can get behind.
Right. It really truly is. So alchemy and Gnosticism, Hermeticism played a big role in that separation because it's these Neoplatonic attitudes, this dualism between spirit and body that is injected into Christianity to make it what it is, which is another reason why alchemy gets to stick around, why it's not sentenced to death like some of the other pagan practices, is because it is all about saying, okay, we're pure spirit, impure flesh, let's figure that out. Let's refine ourselves and purify ourselves. And so the early church was all right with it. They could get behind it and they moved forward. There's writings regarding Hermes Trismegistus and other alchemical ideas, Gnostic ideas and all of that from as early as, I want to say, the 120s AD that we have. So it's
pretty good.
It grew up right alongside the other movement. But the Hermetic texts, which were compiled into their final canonical form in Alexandria in the first and second century, are very much a product of this time. The Neoplatonists, such as Plotinus, who was born in the early 200s CE, sought to better understand and even personify what Plato refers to as the demiurge. Now, this demiurge is another key component of Gnosticism and therefore of our Hermetic arts and our alchemical arts. The demiurge, as described by Plato, is the force which shapes material reality. And in some interpretations, due to the duality between body and spirit, it is actually seen as a great cosmic enemy, this demiurge, something to be overcome and something to be destroyed. However, even in such thought as that, the demiurge is usually not identified with the prime mover, the initial cause of creation, but rather as an agent of that cause. We following?
I think so.
For instance, taking into account Plato's philosophy of the forms, the demiurge is not the precedent form of the good, which Plato referred to as the one or the monad of Pythagorean philosophy. Rather, the demiurge emerged from the one, and then it created and shaped the material reality. So it is not the source of being, it is the shaper of being. Does that make sense? Is that better?
Yes.
Cool. I just threw that Pythagorean thing in just to zing you.
I was like, wait a second.
Put a triangle up there.
You made me think for a moment.
Now, the Gnostics themselves took this Platonic cosmology and they rent the unified universe into a dualistic one, with the demiurge taking stage as the antagonist, opposing the good initial cause, the prime mover, the uncreated God, or later in Christianity, Jesus Christ. However, it's important to realize that the demiurge would not be appropriate to identify with what we would think of as supreme evil or even the devil. Instead, it's really only because of the Gnostics' weird dualistic perspective that it's seen as evil, which is perhaps a more advanced reimagining of far ancient forms of religion such as Zoroastrianism, which have always portrayed the universe as a divine struggle, product of a divine struggle, a conflict between absolute good and absolute evil. Technically, this demiurge is a morally neutral agent. It is here where we see theurgy kind of put into the system. When we're looking at transmuting, especially material reality, things like the Philosopher's Stone, things like even just the normal alchemical recipes, it is this demiurge that was supposedly, in ritual, being harnessed in order to shape our materials into different things. So, we kind of talked about that. Now, when Jewish philosophy speaks of the soul and its relation to the body. The soul is something which proceeds from the body. It is the core and essence of one's being. It is the soul which is the spark of the divine, which allows mankind to commune with the divine. And while God is a being of pure spirit without a physical form, it is a testament to how other God is from ourselves that the soul is not conceptualized as being the same substance that he is, but rather the type of being that he is. We do not have within us God, but we have something that can speak to God, and that is what the soul is. Consciousness, loving kindness, caring for each other, that's the soul. It's not what makes us other than human beings, it's not something separate from us, but it's what makes us so completely human. If somebody was unable to love, like Jason, then we wouldn't think of them as a full-fledged human, regardless of their biology. We'd think there was something wrong with them. And again, that is the primary difference between these two ideas. Now,
keep
you
along.
Good?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Keep going.
I appreciate you. Thank you for sitting through this. And thank you guys for sitting through this too. Now, while what the Gnostics believed was in opposition to the kind of cultural context of the monotheism that was practiced by Jews and then ostensibly by the later Christians, as we've kind of just mentioned, the monotheistic sentiment that is found within the Hermetica and Hermeticism did not go unnoticed. In fact, some of the most influential early Christian thinkers, such as St. Augustine of Hippo and Lactantius, regarded Hermes Trismegistus as a sort of prophet of Christianity, hundreds or even more years before the Advent. This happened because of an interesting philosophy, which was partially responsible for this rise. I'm sorry, you're falling asleep. I thought this was interesting.
It's dense information is all.
Everybody's going to hate this.
Nope. I'll do something fun in the background.
That'll keep them going.
I'll put some arrows pointing to me as I slowly drift away.
Just remove yourself from the shot. Some of the most influential early Christian thinkers, such as St. Augustine of Hippo and Lactantius, regarded Hermes Trismegistus as a prophet of Christianity, hundreds or more years before the Advent. This happened because of an interesting philosophy which was partially responsible for the rise of Hermeticism and the widespread acceptance of alchemy, which is referred to as Prisca Theologia, or ancient theology. Prisca Theologia is a doctrine of belief which claims that the truth that was handed from God to man in the ancient days was then dispersed throughout all of the cultures of Earth, and that by looking at all of the different cultures and all of their different belief systems, you would be able to find one unifying theological system that pointed towards the supreme and divine truth. Thus, Hermes Trismegistus was a pagan prophet which pointed forward to the ultimate revelation of God's truth and nature. Even his name was seen by these thinkers as evidence of the divine Trinity being inherent in nature and therefore marking him as a servant of the truth. It is most likely this idea that led to the Hermetic arts being preserved, even after Diocletian ordered the burning of all alchemical texts in Alexandria in response to a revolt. Which means that alchemists were dangerous enough to do a revolt. Like a specifically alchemical revolt. That's Full Metal Alchemist, is it not? Is not Diocletian simply Emperor Bradley?
Sure.
Okay.
It's been a long time since I've watched Full Metal.
Oh, I see how it is. You came in with the Full Metal Alchemist references. You're not even ready to back it up.
I'm not.
That's disappointing. I'm fine with that. That's disappointing.
What's disappointing is the fact that I had a triple shot and I am sleepy.
That's why you need to drink tea.
Bull. BS. Let's go.
However, it was around this time of this revolt, the end of the second century. This says the end of the secret century, which is even cooler.
Ooh.
The end of the second century.
No one knows where it went.
That the Hermetic texts were lost to the West for a few hundred years before they resurfaced from a Byzantine source. These first texts, again, either 13 or 15 of them total, are what form the core of Hermeticism. This is the majority of what remains, and due to an effort to stamp out Gnosticism, of which Hermeticism was and continues to be a major component, a huge amount of this information was lost forever. Yet, it is not in this core collection that we find Trismegistus' treaty on alchemy, which has so informed the quest that we find ourselves on, this understanding. Especially through the Renaissance times, to master the powers of transmutation. You see, alchemy and Gnosticism, as I hope I have just spent an hour boring you to get you to realize, are intimately related. Which is why I took up so much of your time to give you the context that you either crave, as I do, or absolutely despise, like so many of our iTunes reviewers do. Here's...
Yo, are we a little salty with that, or what?
Here's the point of it. They talk too much. Give me the facts. I'm giving you the facts. Don't tell me to give you the facts. Don't tell me what I already know, Travis. That was a Zootopia reference in a show about alchemy. Walt Disney would be proud. It's been such a long day.
I mean, cryo-freezing, that kind of makes sense.
I don't think that's
kind of
true.
Similar-esque.
Right? That's got to not be
true. Is that just like an internet myth?
I'm pretty sure that's just a conspiracy.
I'm pretty sure he's on ice.
Disney on ice. I'm sure that joke's been made before, which is a shame. Here's the point of everything I just said.
Okay.
Alchemy began, and some would argue, is currently finding its end, or will soon, as a spiritual practice. We'll be looking very shortly at some of the ways it was used in a very real and very physical sense, but at its beginning, alchemy reflects a way of looking at the world that is inherently Gnostic. This material is crude and bad, it is subservient to the spiritual. The work of life, then, is to purify the material in order to better obtain the spiritual wall in this life to make our existence in the next life all the more worthwhile. And it is not too hard to see how this has invaded many aspects of modern spirituality, from the New Age movement to some philosophies of pretty much all of the different world religions who act like life doesn't really start until you die. This belief and worldview will later, and I promise we will see later, be played out in the Renaissance.
Okay.
And its surrounding eras as a way of pursuing material wealth by way of transmutation.
That's what I'm talking
That's
about.
What he's all about. We're going to get there. But the earlier writings attributed to Trismegistus make it clear that the goal is not to transmute lead into gold, but rather to transmute the body into spirit, into soul, and to live as a purely spiritual being while still chained and trapped in this material world. Now, being rediscovered a millennia or so later, their contents of this Hermetica corpus, or Corpus Hermetica is what it's referred to, they were either misunderstood or, as was popularly believed by those at the time, and very well may be the case, decoded by these Renaissance thinkers. Again, there is enough evidence to show alchemy as an actual physical art, a physical transmutation of different substances by way of interacting with different sources, different heat, different elements, all of that. That did happen in the past, in the ancient past, because all of this is in the past.
Most of it's quite distant.
And in fact, even now, we're in the past. Because there's always like a 0.005 second delay or something, millisecond delay in you seeing something and your brain processing it.
Right. Yes. We are always experiencing the past.
That sucks. But I also love it.
Sure.
And yet we can only think forward to the future. Well, that's not true. We can think even further back. But what I'm saying is we can't live in the present. We can't live in the space between the past and the future like we think we do. This is all hopefully going to make sense why I'm talking like this. Because this is basically what I just said was alchemy. I hope you'll see what I mean. Rather...
Now? Do I get to see now?
No. Maybe, depending on our time. What time are we at? Nope. Well, maybe we'll get to it. Now, again, it is not the Corpus Hermeticum that founds alchemy for all intents and purposes. Instead, it is the inscription of a curious tablet carved into emerald that would set those later alchemists on their quest. As with so much that has to do with the occult and the mysterious, it's not known for sure exactly where this inscription comes from, with the mention of it starting at least in the 7th or 8th century work called the Book of Balinus the Wise on the Causes, written in Arabic, complete with commentary and translation. Translation of the tablet, that is.
Okay.
Another translation of the tablet comes to us from around 800 AD, also written in Arabic, this time by an alchemist named Jabir Hayyan, or Jabir ibn Hayyan. The stories say that it is much older than that, however, this emerald tablet. For those alchemists who... That... Alchemists? Alchemists? Whoa. That was weird. For those alchemists who do and did regard the Hebrew Bible as truth, they claim that the emerald tablet was given to Seth. Seth was the third son of Adam, who replaced Abel as the good one after he was killed. That must have just been a terrible family to be a part of. It was given by God to Seth directly. Now, the tablet was kept by the Sethite priestly class and then preserved through the flood of Noah, who then hid it in Hebron, where the tomb of the patriarchs remains to this day. From there, it was discovered by Miriam, Moses' sister, who put it in the Ark of the Covenant. Now, other stories claim that instead it was discovered in a secret chamber under the Pyramid of Cheops in 1350 BC, that it somehow made its way into a cave, where almost a millennium later, it was happened upon by a very wise and yet very mortal man named Hermes, who discovered and understood the tablet and became like unto a god. Yet, being still a mortal man, he died and was buried with the tablet. When Alexander the Great...
So a wise man that went cave spelunking? Yes. And just wound up being able to read this sweet emerald tablet?
Who does that remind you of? Batman.
Indiana Jones, but okay. Oh, yeah.
It is very Indiana Jones. There's actually one point that is explicitly very Indiana Jones in all of this that we'll be getting to in just a moment here. Now, when Alexander the Great became the ruler of Egypt, he learned of the secrets of the tablet, and he traveled with speed to find it. He added it to his treasures and took it out of the country, hiding it where it would later be discovered by Balinus. Again, that's the guy who wrote the book that had the tablet, the first translation of the tablet.
Okay.
Theoretically. Because it probably wasn't actually. Balinus is identified with a man named Apollonius of Tyana. Now, Apollonius was a Neo-Pythagorean philosopher who lived in the first century Common Era. He was a wandering and iterant preacher who went about talking with people and sharing philosophical concepts. While there are references to him from around the ancient world, it was about 100 years after his death that Philostratus, a Greek sophist living in Imperial Rome, wrote the only surviving biography of Apollonius that we have left. It is this man, supposedly, who first translated the Emerald Tablet, which was left by Alexander after his death, or else by some other missing link in the story, supposedly any one of a host of Old Testament or New Testament characters.
Okay.
But there's something a little else going on here.
Really?
Really.
Can't be that simple.
Hermes the Thrice Great.
Our old boy Hermes.
May actually be, according to some alchemists, the merging of three distinct individuals. Three people. Two of which, who definitely lived. One of which, who may have lived. The one person, that's the right finger. If I had done this with any other fingers, it wouldn't have worked. That's all for the video, guys. The one individual who may not have existed was another son of Adam and Eve, named Hermes. which is very, very anachronistic, but I'll let it be. Elsewise, he is also identified as Seth himself. Seth is the first Hermes, or Hermes is the first Hermes. From there, the tablet moves from the first Hermes to a later incarnation of Hermes, who is somebody else that we spent a good amount of time talking about on this podcast, the pharaoh Akhenaten. Do you remember Akhenaten?
I remember Akhenaten.
My boy, my man, that weirdo-looking dude. Akhenaten,
yeah, say that again.
Akhenaten, who is...
Kind of fits.
Yeah, exactly. He's famous because, or infamous, because he took the polytheistic and
the rule breaker,
very polytheistic system of ancient Egypt and tried to unify it into a at least monolatrous system, if not truly monotheistic. So maybe he didn't actually deny all of the other gods and put them away, but at least he wouldn't worship any of them or even consider them as worthy of worship. His one god was the Aten, the solar disk. This is very, very, very suspiciously closely identified with alchemy. Just straight up. Just straight up. It is very strange because alchemy, as we'll see, is it comes from a prime source, a singular source that out of which comes all of creation that is then used and moved and all of this and the other. So for Akhenaten to take all of the Egyptian pantheon and condense it into one solar disk, and then to theoretically use that disk to manipulate reality and the such, you can really see why people think, okay, all right, maybe that does fit a little bit. Then, after Akhenaten's death,
okay,
Hermes Trismegistus is reincarnated for the third and potentially final time as Apollonius of Tyana. Apollonius is an interesting figure. There's some good legends. There's some good things about him. He was said to have like the ability to see, for instance, even from 1,000 miles away, to see when the evil Roman emperor died, and he announced it to everybody. But he also was supposedly the one who not only found this tablet, but actually wrote it and understood it, or at least communicated it in a way that began the study of alchemy for real in the more modern period. So you have the far primordial ancient period, first Hermes, okay, Seth or Seth's unknown brother. Then you have the ancient period, yet still historical, and you'd have Akhenaten. And then entering us into the new age, the common era, right at the start of it. I mean, this Apollonius is so closely identified with miracle working and this and that, that he is off and in the same area in the same place. He is often pointed to as a either prototype, archetype, or imposter of Jesus himself, because he is so closely identified with the kinds of things Jesus was doing. Therefore, he becomes the final Hermes, which ushers alchemy into its fullest age. Then it dies off for a very long time. Now, another quick side note.
Yeah.
There are these claims, like I said, of Apollonius himself being Hermes. We just talked about that. But there are also the claims of this Hermetic core of works, the Corpus Hermetica. Now, if I told you that somebody wrote a book, this book, for instance, this book, The Fellowship, The Literary Lives of the Inklings, was written by Philip Zaleski and Carol Zaleski. You, and I both, and you would think, okay, these people sat down at a typewriter, at a computer, whatever. They wrote this book, they published the book, and now we have the book. So when I say that these books were written by Hermes Trismegistus, people are going to scoff, obviously. He was either a historical person from way back when and we forgot about him, which is not super likely, or he's a god. And a god is not going to sit down and write a book. But if instead of saying...
I mean, he has plenty of time.
Well, he's got nothing but time.
Exactly.
And Thoth did write 36,250 books.
Exactly.
So... he's got plenty of time. But for us to be able to hold these books in our hands, we as moderns know and understand that a god did not come down and put his pen to a paper and write this book.
I would have just snapped.
What? Oh, and made it so. And maybe he did. He probably didn't. So when we look...
My thought doesn't travel that fast to fill up a full book.
Did you remember that Fairly Odd Parents episode where they could eat books?
What?
They could eat books and then know what
Gain
was in the
knowledge.
Book. Yep, and it is my dream.
Talk about a high-fiber diet.
Yep. Oh, Lord. That was bad.
Yeah.
So...
Hopefully that ink had lead in it.
So, instead, rather than saying, Hermes wrote this book, J.R.R. Tolkien wrote Lord of the Rings, you know. Instead, what would be better understood is that some other being wrote Lord of the Rings, and J.R.R. Tolkien wrote it down for them. Let's call him the Master of Fantasy. He wrote Lord of the Rings, and then J.R.R. Tolkien, through his life of spiritual practice and purification, of being suppliant to a higher power, was deemed worthy to communicate this higher power's message. And therefore, while the book may say The Lord of the Rings, a story in three parts written by J.R.R. Tolkien, instead it should actually say The Lord of the Rings written by the Master of Fantasy. It is the exact same situation with the works of Hermes Trismegistus. Almost none of his followers, and certainly no one in the modern era, is saying that Hermes himself came and wrote these books. Except for the people who think that he was actually physically incarnated and then died, and again, we kind of went over
so
that.
So some people are saying he physically
wrote
books.
Some people are saying
that. Some people don't.
Most people don't.
I would like to point out that I think J.R.R. Tolkien was a perfectly good writer.
Oh, yeah. I agree. But the Master of Fantasy is
a greater writer. I don't think he channeled
writer.
The Master of Fantasy.
He was doing something otherworldly. He's
experiencing a world war. That's,
I'll do
that's
it.
One thing.
So, much like the muses of ancient Greece, Hermes Trismegistus works as an inspiration. He works as a source for information to be transmuted. And that is why all of these works bear his name, even though they were most likely not written by a god physically. Most likely.
I hope you do realize you're just going to be pulling that book out of thin air, and you're going to be placing it back into thin air. Stop. Stop.
This is another very good book, Tell the Machine Goodnight, a novel by Katie Williams. Just so you all know. I just wanted to pull it out and put it back. So, the work of Hermes Trismegistus, almost universally, are comprised of works, for lack of a better word, channeled through human authors. Why did I just spend so much time talking about that?
Because you don't like me.
Because the Emerald Tablet, however, is not like this at all.
It is written by a god.
It is written by a god. Which
I can't wait to read it.
Which is why it's a little different. That I kind of trapped myself there. It's different when people do say, okay, we've got it. We've got Seth, we've got Akhenaten, and we've got Apollonius. It is actually written by a god in that sense. They are the god. The god is them, and they are doing this.
So how long did it take to write this thing? On a tablet?
On a tablet of emerald.
How big is a tablet?
Yay big.
So this is like one of those...
About the size of an iPad mini.
So
which
like,
is a
like
shame.
In school, and your teacher's like, all right,
yeah.
you get one page of notes.
Yeah, exactly.
You just write it real small on that tablet.
Real small. So small.
Gotcha. Now I'm following. That's why it took three lifetimes to figure it out.
Yeah.
And to write it.
Keep figuring, keep making it happen. Yeah. You know.
I know nothing.
Now, the Emerald Tablet is the word of Trismegistus himself, inscribed by him in order to set humanity on the right course. Now, a common belief among alchemists throughout the centuries and their modern-day counterparts is that the Emerald Tablet, far from being the product of centuries of Hermetic thought, is in fact its origin. See, the secrets contained on the Emerald Tablet are believed to be the endowment of power that was given to the students of the mystery schools of old, which popped up around the Hermetic traditions. This is not necessarily impossible, as these mystery schools in the ancient world are notoriously good at keeping their secrets, like, for instance, the mystery school at Eleusis, where every year the would-be initiates came through, and they went through the ceremony. We don't know what happened. We knew it had something to do with the...
Wolf's blood.
We knew it had something to do with the story of Persephone being abducted by Hades and of Demeter searching for Persephone in the underworld. But...
Sounds spooky.
It's fantastic. The only thing we know for sure about the spiritual impact of this is that this moment, after the completing of the ritual, what everything built up to, and this took days, what everything built up to was that these initiates were taken one by one and shown a great mystery. And the mystery was in a box. The box was opened. They looked inside. And they saw only a single ear of grain that had been reaped in absolute silence. The box was closed, and they left a part of the mystery school. That's the one that we know about, and it doesn't make any sense. So, you have to think about all of the ones we don't know about, like the Dionysian mystery cults, like pretty much every god had a mystery cult, the Orphic mystery cults. They all had their own little mystery schools, and we don't know anything about them. So, what I'm saying here...
Wait, are we talking about cultists or alchemy? What are we doing?
Yes, all of it. What I'm saying here is that even though the earliest recording of the inscription of this tablet does not come until about 800 AD, it is more than possible to actually be the ancient secret that fueled the study of Hermeticism. Furthermore, those with a real interest and who are very smart, who look at these things, they see that when you look at the Emerald Tablet, it almost provides some sort of a key to the Hermetic writings themselves, as if those writings were written with the tablet in mind. So, it is obviously impossible to tell where...
So wait, where is this tablet now?
Yeah. Who knows? Not me. That's the point, isn't it? That's the point.
Yeah.
It is impossible...
That's the point.
It is impossible to tell what came first and where everything came from here, but at least for the people that we'll be talking about for the remainder of our series, it's important to remember that this is the assumption that they're working off of, that the Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus is written by Hermes Trismegistus himself. It is the core distillation of the knowledge that created the universe, and they can use it for all sorts of things. Now, one such individual, as we'll spend more time talking about later, but not today, is Sir Isaac Newton.
Okay.
There we go.
All right.
He's awake. He's alive.
You got me back in this. All right, talk about apples.
In 1680, Isaac Newton himself made his own translation and text, or translation and commentary on the text of the Emerald Tablet. He made this commentary most likely based off of the standard Latin translation, which was popular among alchemists at the time. Now, according to Pseudo-Apollonius, the tablet was discovered under a statue of Hermes in Turkey, in a vault, a tomb, upon which a skeleton sat on a throne of gold, holding the tablet in his hands. That's the Indiana Jones part.
That makes a lot of sense.
The earliest account of the tablet reads thusly, quote, truth, certainty, that in which there is no doubt, that which is above is from that which is below, and that which is below is from that which is above, working the miracles of one, as all things were from the one. Its father is the sun, and its mother the moon. The earth carried it in her belly. And the wind nourished it in her belly. As the earth, which shall become fire, feed the earth from that which is subtle with the greatest power. It ascends from the earth to the heaven and becomes ruler over that which is above and that which is below.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't feel like that tells me how to become God.
That's exactly the problem. You don't think that. You don't see that. You don't know the secrets of Hermes Trismegistus.
So here's the thing.
Tell me the thing.
One thing that I've absolutely noticed is that whenever I see a bumper sticker,
yeah,
and whatever their statement is on it, yeah, if it ends with an exclamation point, I should probably just go about
ignore
my business.
It. Yeah.
tell me, what are the first three punctuations you have there?
Truth. Certainty.
Exclamation point. Exclamation point.
That in which there is no doubt.
Exclamation point. I'm a little worried. Now, if you have that much enthusiasm about this...
Well, then it must be true.
Or...
It must be very important.
It hasn't bored you to death to where you have to write it down.
Well, that's true. Now, this inscription changes throughout the years, and a more readable, less shouty version comes to us from, as we had mentioned, Isaac Newton. All right, his translation reads thusly, quote, "'Tis true without lying, certain and most true. That which is above is like that which is below." Oh, I messed it up, and now the incantation won't work, and our listeners won't turn into true alchemists. So let me try this again, and then I want you to enjoy the power that we are giving you.
It doesn't even matter. Did you just ruin it?
Just forget I said all of that. All
right,
and
pause.
As you sleep tonight,
pause,
ignore
here.
All of the dreams.
Come back the next day. We have 24-hour reset.
Yep.
Sam, continue.
The gods will know. 'Tis true without lying, certain and most true. That which is below is like that which is above, and that which is above is like that which is below, to do the miracles of one only thing. And as all things have been and arose from one by the mediation of one, so all things have their birth from this one thing by adaptation. The sun is its father, the moon its mother, the wind hath carried it in its belly, the earth is its nurse. The father of all perfection in the whole world is here. Its force or power is entire if it be converted into earth. Separate thou the earth from the fire, the subtle from the gross, sweetly with great industry. It ascends from the earth to the heaven, and again it descends to the earth, and receives the force of things superior and inferior. By this means you shall have the glory of the whole world, and thereby all obscurity shall fly from you. It is force above all force, for it vanquishes every subtle thing and penetrates every solid thing. So was the world created. From this are and do come admirable adaptations, whereof the mean in here is the where... Well, we'll just edit that one, because I'm not starting over. Whereof the means is here in this. Hence I am called Hermes Trismegistus, having the three parts of the philosophy of the whole world. That which I have said of the operation of the sun is accomplished and ended. Well, now that seems simple enough, doesn't it?
I'm not going to lie, I kind of zoned out there in the middle of it, but yeah!
Well, if you're on board, and I'm on board, then maybe it's time that we go ahead and get cracking, and we start pursuing that great, age-old wonder, the mystery of the Philosopher's Stone, which will be the subject of our next episode in what might turn out to be 500 episodes about alchemy. That's all I got. I hope that was enjoyable for at least one person. It was hella enjoyable for me. I was digging all of it.
I am so glad you had a blast. I was present.
He was present. He did his best.
I did my best.
He talked a little bit.
Okay, so as a recap.
Okay.
This is all just kind of a precursor and a leading up to the Philosopher's Stone, and essentially how alchemy has become a spiritual...
How alchemy was a spiritual.
Right. Moved from a spiritual, ritual-esque manner to potentially a more physical.
Yeah. Yeah. This was all context. And I tweeted and I told you people.
Okay. So now that we've got the context out of the way for probably what's going to be a big hitting episode next week or the week after that or the week after that or the week after that or the week after that.
Who knows when we'll record next? It's a mystery.
What else do we need to talk about today, Sam, before we head on out?
Nothing much. I mean, I guess we have some things to talk about.
It's the usual, Sam.
Oh, the usual. That's what you want. Okay.
That's, I am trying to lead us out of this, because to be honest, I don't know how much video my phone will capture at once. I haven't touched anything. I hope it's still going. We're about to find out.
We should really put a mirror behind it, right?
Just so we can watch it?
Yeah. That's actually and then a that way we idea. Could also see like our positions and how we're looking on it. And if I'm...
well, you shake the table like no tomorrow from all your repositioning.
I'm sorry. It's going to be rough.
That's okay. We'll get better.
Yeah. So next week we're going to start with kind of analyzing the Emerald Tablet as
and
best
by next
as...
week, we do mean next episode, not...
Right. It's a metaphorical
actually...
week. I think you should all know that by now, because that's how it's been for the last, like, 6 months. I say next week, it's never next week. It's, like, 1 to 2 to 3 weeks out.
What is time?
Ideally, it's going to be 2 weeks. But, school,
we'll
man.
See,
I could have written... I don't know. What could I have written? I could have written my 500-word essay about the frickin' Romans. Instead, I wrote 4,100 words about alchemy, and yet they won't give me college credit for it because they hate me. And I hate me. And Jason hates me.
That's not necessarily true. You just bug me from time to time.
So, yes,
hatred is just it's so much
it's a
effort.
Whole different thing. Next week, we are going to start by kind of decoding the Emerald Tablet to show the first and most important primary components and conceptions of alchemy and how that relates to the Philosopher's Stone.
Okay.
And then my plan is to take a look through the different eras and the different civilizations of the pursuit of the stone itself. So again, we have at least 2 more episodes, and then, because we have to do at least the stone and then the European Renaissance, but again, there's some Kabbalah in this. There's a good amount of Sufism and Arabic, Islamic mysticism that I'd like to talk about as well. Because alchemy is just the doorway to all of these things that I want to talk about. Welcome to the new Not Alone podcast. We might be spooky. We might not. We're really bad at planning. We always do this. Every October, I can't remember what it was last year, we decide to do episodes about the least spooky things possible.
Hey, you have to have a balance.
It's true.
Everyone else is getting spooky.
That's true. You're here to learn about ancient philosophies.
Apparently.
Apparently. Which reminds me. We've been asking for them. We haven't really got any. We've gotten a few. But
some stories?
If we want to do a listener special, guys, we're all about it.
Oh, boy.
We just need you to send in your stories. Send them to notalonepodcast@gmail.com because I still didn't look up what that other email was. If you know what that email is, send it there because I'll find it eventually. But for the time being, you can send it to notalonepodcast@gmail.com. We'll be able to read your stories. You're free to write them out. You're free to record them in audio form or in video form. And if you do decide to do video form, we'll probably just edit you in and you'll literally be a part of the show.
Just right back there.
Just right back. Holy, that'd be so... Oh, I'm not going to touch the screen. That'd be so cool. Like, just imagine your head here as we just gaze adoringly at you. That is what you could have if you record a video for us to use in our listener special at the end of the month. Beyond that, guys, we don't have a whole lot. I do want to talk about really quick and thank one individual... deleted and rearranged everything on my iPad, and now I don't know where anything is. We'd like to thank one individual for becoming one of our patrons. Their name is Adriana Benamore.
Woo! Adriana!
Thank you so much for supporting the show. You can learn more about doing that at patreon.com/notalonepodcast. It's what keeps these lights on.
These big,
literally,
beautiful
big,
lights.
Beautiful,
that are
very hot lights.
Burning my eyes. Pretty great.
And as we move forward, I just want to reaffirm, I guess, our commitment, which is fair for you to question because we have been slacking. But we are here. We're going to be doing this. As we go forward, our subject matter might change a little, like it is with this, for instance, just because it's kind of hard to find more stories about dogmen. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's a lot more stories about the wolfmen. And if so, let me know.
If you have a lead, let us, yeah.
If,
put us on the scent.
We're really, truly happy to accept like any sorts of, oh, I think you should cover this or that. You can send that all to notalonepodcast@gmail.com. But we're not planning on going anywhere. In fact, if we have our way, we might even kind of try to ramp up production a little bit. So feel free, if you want to support the show, head on over there to patreon.com/notalonepodcast. If you want to support the show in another way, you could also go ahead and leave us an iTunes review. I can't check that on my iPad, so...
Or, fingers crossed...
is...
a YouTube comment.
Oh,
or
yeah!
Something.
A YouTube comment.
What?
Subscribe. Like, hit the say the thing.
No, because
share,
I'm not
like,
trash.
Share, like, and subscribe.
You can share if you'd like to, or if this is like
smash
your guilty
that
pleasure,
subscribe
that's fine,
button.
Too.
I'm not even subscribed to our own podcast anymore. We have a few people to thank.
You could do that? That feels like voting for yourself.
I guess. I mean, I do sometimes go on and just hit the rating button. I don't know if it counts my ratings every time, but I just say, yeah, I'm 5 stars. Holy crap! We surpassed 300 written customer reviews, and only a few of those are jerks. Thank you.
That's
all.
What's up.
That's awesome. Speaking of those reviews, we would like to thank Raven Nation 1 and Wraith Black.
Ooh.
We're gonna
that
go ahead.
Spooky.
That is spooky. We're gonna go ahead and thank Wraith Black. They say perfect for driving. I don't know if that's true. I love this podcast. It's perfect for my job, which consists of driving. It's history. It is history. It's a lot of history. He didn't say that. I said that. They didn't say that. It could. Who knows who this person is? It's history with a paranormal slant, and I really like how they are not really short like a lot of others are. It's a feature, not a bug. Thank
right.
you both. Thank you, Wraith Black, for affirming that I'm not a failure after all. I need that every day in every way. That being said, it's alchemy. Alky time.
I think we're good here.
I have drank in so much tea.
Join us next time on the hunt for the Philosopher's Stone.
I've been working since
Sam, I did
7
it last
a.m.
week.
I'm tired. Remember, whether you find yourself exploring the tombs of the Great Pyramid of Cheops, or you find yourself cast out from the Garden of Eden with nothing but an emerald tablet to lead you and your family back to that perfect life.
That doesn't seem that half bad.
You are not alone.